by the way, we had to move Jeff Daniels to tomorrow. Sorry about that. Once again, disregard the host. Pay no attention to the man behind the microphone. You're used to that by now, I'm sure. It's Current State on WKAR. We're glad you're along. It is really interesting to see how many states, just like Michigan, are enjoying budget surpluses heading into 2014 and how they propose to use them. David Lieb of the Associated Press writes that California, which is often blasted for fiscal mismanagement, deficits to the moon, economists forecast a $3.2 billion surplus. Governor Jerry Brown wants to divide that between paying down debt and increased spending. But what governors are calling for aren't necessarily what you might expect. In New York, Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo is calling for a tax cut, despite others in his party calling for increased spending. In Louisiana, Republican Bobby Jindal wants to invest his surplus in education and health care. Dave Lieb writes, the National Association of State Budget Officers projects that almost all states will see fairly decent budget pluses in their 2014 budgets, which makes the fact that it is also an election year all the more interesting. It's Current State on WKAR. The response to comments by Republican National Committeeman Dave Ajima of Michigan has intensified in recent days. Ajima's remarks critical of gays and Muslims triggered rebukes from across the political spectrum and has especially embarrassed his fellow Republicans. Last Sunday, 3 days after Michigan Governor Rick Snyder made a veiled reference to Ajima by calling for greater civility in his State of the State address, an influential Michigan Republican called him out by name in a column written by our next guest. A former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, Betsy DeVos, railed against Ajima's comments for their intolerance and insensitivity, and she said he should resign his position. In its lead editorial yesterday, the paper agreed. Nolan Finley is the editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Nolan, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark. Good to be with you.
What can you tell us? Can you tell us any more about the fallout from both of these columns, the response to these columns?
Well, the opposition to Ajima seems to be growing. The calls for his resignation are now increasing. You had 3 members of the congressional delegation asking him to resign at the meeting today in Washington, the RNC meeting. I don't know how he survives this. He is elected to represent a party, and when the leaders of that party feel like he can no longer do so effectively, I don't know how he survives. I just don't see how he gets through this.
Talk to us about the Republican response to this controversy. The mainstream appears to be calling for his resignation.
Absolutely, and you know there's been some discomfort with Ajima for quite some time now, based on his really vitriolic Facebook postings about gays and gay rights and what have you. I mean, they went beyond just the idea of opposition to gay marriage or opposition to gay rights. They went right to really hateful comments about the nature of homosexuality, etc.
How are your readers responding to your column from last Sunday and your column yesterday calling for him to resign?
Well, I mean, it's mixed. You have a lot of folks who were waiting for someone like Betsy DeVos to take the lead on this and have joined in the call. And then you have a lot of people who support Ajima still and who believe he is speaking the truth and should be allowed to speak. So I wouldn't say it's 100% of the folks in opposition by any means.
Did Betsy DeVos's criticism surprise you?
I'm not so sure it surprised me. I mean, I think a lot of people hold those views. What it did was, what surprised me, I guess, was her willingness to take the lead on this. And, you know, the bosses have always been a little bit associated with the religious right. And I think that, she took a risk here in turning off perhaps some of her own base. But I think in talking to her, I got the feeling that this was very much a matter of conscience with her, and that she didn't feel like she could stay silent any longer.
Some cynics complain that this is more about winning elections than a heartfelt expression of tolerance and inclusion. What do you think?
I think it's probably a little of both. I mean, politics is always about winning elections, so I don't think there's anything unique about that this time. I just don't think that was the case in for Betsy. I just got the real feeling that she was concerned that her party was being led too far to the extreme, too far outside the mainstream, and that the party leadership was too weak in standing up to this movement. And, yeah, I think she is worried that the party's future is at risk.
We're talking with Nolan Finley, who's the editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Besides party affiliation, how much history do the DeVosses and Dave Ajima share? Do you know? I mean, does this mark a split, or has there been tension in the past?
I don't know. I really don't know about the relationship. I wouldn't speculate. You know, they're both from the Grand Rapids area, but that's all I know in terms of their commonality.
Okay.
Well, Betsy herself is a former National Committee woman. She's done this job. She knows how this job should be done, and I think she was really upset, concerned that Dave wasn't doing the job the way it should be done. You're there to help the party to broaden its appeal, not to shut the door, not to make yourself the center of attention, and not to do the party harm.
What do you make of Governor Snyder's apparent reluctance to explicitly address Mr. Ajima's comments?
Well, I wish he would speak a little more clearly on it. He has twice now, once yesterday, once in the State of the State, made comments that were clearly aimed at Ajima. I don't know what he's waiting for. He had Candace Miller, Justin Amash, other noted party leaders putting their, you know, position out there. And if he feels this way, if he feels he's hurting the party, and if he feels that he has brought incivility to the political dialogue, then he should name names.
I'd like to ask you a few questions involving Brooks Patterson as well. He's been in the news, of course, for his most recent comments about Detroit, as reported in The New Yorker. The article says he acknowledges being a Detroit basher and compared the city to an Indian reservation, among other things. What do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, I know Brooks, and I know, you know, how he speaks. I also know what he does. And, you know, for him to say, I'm a Detroit basher, if you put that in context, every time he offers a criticism of the way things are working in Detroit, he's called a Detroit basher. He draws that sort of lightning. And I also know he speaks sort of unfiltered. So I can imagine somebody coming in here who didn't know him and was looking to do what apparently this reporter was looking to do as a real hatchet job on a conservative Republican. You know, it's a field day because he is unfiltered. But I took a look yesterday at the things he said, and I didn't find, you know, the Detroit bashing, the racism, et cetera, that perhaps some others found in them. You know, he talked, much was made about the fact that when his children come down for a Tiger game, he warns them, don't stop at a gas station in Detroit. Well, I'll tell you, when Shalonda Buckman, the education activist, had her car hijacked at gunpoint on Jefferson Avenue, one of the city's main thoroughfares, last fall, a lot of people were saying that same thing. Black, white, suburban Detroit, didn't matter. A lot of people were saying that same thing. Brooks' problem is he says things, you know, the things everybody else says between each other, he says in, you know, in public and in front of a microphone. And as for his reservation comment, when this was a comment he made many years ago, and he was asked about it, whether, you know, he still felt that you know, Detroit was the equivalent of an Indian reservation. Well, I would defy anyone to get out of downtown, get off the freeways, drive through those neighborhoods and tell me that they don't see large stretches of wasteland where the population is almost entirely dependent on the government and trapped in a geographic area with no hope of getting out, no commerce, no jobs. And I believe that's what Brooks was referring to, and it's hard to fault the facts of what he said. The way he said it perhaps was not as politic as it should be, but what he said was not untrue.
But could, Nolan, could some number of Republicans benefit? Could the larger party benefit by having key members of the party choose their words more carefully?
Well, it's, you know, I think that's any political party could. You know, Republicans tend to get much more scrutiny from the media when they have people say things that are outrageous. But you have Democrats every day all over the country saying really, really odd things about the country and its values and its people, and nobody pays any attention. It just gets blown by. So yeah, they need to be extra cautious because they're getting extra scrutiny.
Yeah, you make a good point. I mean, there's always some degree of tension within political parties, but recently the GOP has seen more than its share. In the end, how divided is the GOP right now?
I think no more divided than any other political party at any time. I think that's overblown. You look at the Democratic Party in Michigan, the last gubernatorial election, and tell me that wasn't a divided party, where you had the unions forcing Virge Bonaro on in as the nominee and doing everything they could to defeat Andy Dillon. You had that tension between union and non-union Democrats. I think there's always that sort of attention in the party. Again, I think Republicans are getting far more scrutiny by the media, and they tend to do that. But I don't think it's all that extraordinarily unusual. And I predict it's going to be a very good year for Republicans, primarily because Democrats have handed them this very damaging Obamacare issue.
You are not alone. There are quite a few analysts who still think, at least in Michigan, that Governor Snyder and the Republicans have a good chance of prevailing come November. What else besides, now you alluded to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, what else might be in play there?
In Michigan?
Yeah.
I think the improving economy is going to be in play in Michigan. It's hard for me to see that a incumbent governor gets beat at a time when the economy is improving and growing. I don't care which party you're in. It's hard for an incumbent governor here to get beat, even when the opposite is true, as we saw with Jennifer Granholm's reelection. I think Governor Snyder's going to win and win large. The Democrats seem to be a little dissatisfied again with their nominee. And I think that's going to help down the ticket. I think it's going to help Terry Lynn Land. Remember the popular wisdom on Terry Lynn Land when she got in the race was, oh gosh, we got to find somebody other than Terry. Terry can't win. And you look at these polls, and she's consistently either even or slightly ahead of Gary Peters in the Senate race. I'm not sure the people judged her correctly when she got in the race.
Back in 2010, Governor Snyder criticized unregulated anonymous contributions for issue ads, but recently, as you know, he ended up signing a measure that preserves anonymity of supporters of issue ads. What do you make of that shift?
Well, he's a politician now, not a candidate. You find me a single politician who doesn't have those sort of contradictions on their record after they take office. I can't think of one.
Are contributions to issue ads generating much discussion within the party? Is it causing tension in the GOP, do you think?
No, I don't think it's causing tension within the party. And certainly I don't think it's caught the attention of voters. I'm not sure that's going to be an issue that drives the election. And, we thought back in 2012 that right to work would be one of those issues that where it was in big play in the election. that doesn't seem to be catching fire either. So I think this is all going to be all about jobs and all about the burden imposed by Obamacare.
Were you surprised by Bob King's recent courtship of Gretchen Whitmer to run for governor instead of Mark Schauer?
Well, I wasn't surprised by his sort of having second thoughts about Mark Schauer, whom the UAW encouraged to run. I'm a little surprised that it was Gretchen Whitmer that he went to court. I mean, the Democrats lost big time with one angry candidate 4 years ago. I see her as just being another version of Virge Bonero, somebody who screams a lot and gets mad a lot but doesn't offer much in the way of solutions.
We opened the show with information regarding the budget surpluses that so many states across the country enjoy. Michigan is, of course, one of those. The budget surplus in California, $3.2 billion. I've got to ask you while we've got you on the phone, what you think is going to happen with that surplus?
Well, you know, there'll be $10 billion worth of ideas for spending $1 billion of surplus. That's the way it always is. Danger of a surplus is it's used to expand the government when we're not certain whether or not it's going to be a permanent surplus or not. That's how government gets in trouble. That's how it grows beyond its means. I think as long as you have Michigan roads in the condition they're in, you can't even consider this a surplus. This is money that's fortunately come our way to deal with our infrastructure obligations. We can't keep ignoring our responsibility to fix our roads and maintain our bridges, maintain the avenues of commerce in this state. I believe that's what the money should be used for, and it should be used for that as long as it keeps coming. These ideas of giving everybody a $10, $20, $30 a year, $50 a year tax break, I just think it's not as effective and not as effective an economic driver as fixing our roads. I don't know how they are in Lansing, but I'll tell you, down here, it's like driving on a rural farm rutted road.
Nolan Finley is the editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Nolan, we appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. Bye.
It is Wednesday and time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, when we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature Village Summit, which is a grassroots community center for youth located in Lansing's Fabulous Acres neighborhood. Amel Island is the board president, and Marcus Brown is Village Summit's co-founder. Marcus, who's a teacher in the Lansing Public Schools, explains what motivated him to open the community center.
Well, Village Summit started because I saw a need in my community for additional services and different things to happen, especially for children. I remember specifically talking with my wife one day. We were driving and we were about to go off on vacation somewhere, and I remember one of my children's friends standing in the middle of the street almost like, well, where are you taking my friends to? And I started thinking about, well, we live in a economically depressed area. I remember how many of these kids have ever sat at a table really with a real knife and spoon and fork. How many of these kids have ever really gone on vacation? My children and my wife and I understand that we have been blessed to have enough money to buy books and dictionaries and have computers and internet and be able to travel and do, you know, take our kids to a real restaurant. A lot of people in our community don't have that. And I said it's not really fair to these other kids that they don't have the same thing. So my wife and I decided that we need to start doing a little bit more to help the other children out.
Tell us about your background. You're a teacher in the Lansing schools. What do you teach?
Most years I teach either social studies or language arts. This year I'm teaching fifth grade, which is interesting with all the additional things that are added into the curriculum for us.
Viewing Lansing through the eyes of a public school teacher, what do you see?
Lansing, to me, is a happy middle ground. It's a great place to raise a family. I'm originally from Detroit. My wife's from Kalamazoo, and this was a place that we conscientiously chose to live at. I really love Lansing because you have people from different backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, living inside the same neighborhoods. You don't have enclaves like you would have down in Detroit where neighborhood is 90% one thing or this, that, another thing. There's no telling who you might walk into or who might wind up being your neighbor in Lansing. So I really appreciated that, the diversity and the international backgrounds, immigrant or whatever.
Amel, tell us about the different programs and services you offer.
Tutoring. We offer gardening projects, programs for the neighborhood. And one of our big emphasis is really being that resource center in the neighborhood. We offer computers for people in the neighborhood to use. We teach computer skills. Anybody in the neighborhood can come to the Village Summit and use computers. We started with one computer, but I think now we might have six, where the neighborhood can come in and email and do whatever they need to do with computers. Books, we give away coats, toys at Christmas.
Full service.
Full service.
And then also we provide free lunches during the summertime. And along with the free lunches, being a part of being an area that's a food desert where there are no major grocery stores and a lot of people not having transportation, we also do gardening in the neighborhood. We have about five or six community gardens where people can get access to free fruits and vegetables, tomatoes, lettuce, potatoes, whatever is we have growing out there, hot peppers, whatever.
And you came into a house that became the site of the Village Summit, correct? Can you tell us how that unfolded?
Well, my wife and I purchased a house back in 1995, and then we had a neighbor there that was a librarian. When the economic downturn occurred, she lost her house, and we were kind of concerned about who would move into that house. We saw the house start to fall apart and deteriorate, and this was our neighbor's house, so we started trying to take care of it a little bit. But what happened is the house came back onto the market. We took our retirement money and placed our retirement money towards the house. And we bought the house free and clear and started doing a lot of major renovations on it. And our plan was never to rent out the house or to flip the house, so to speak, but it's always been to use the house to keep that same spirit that the librarian had there. She would have kids stop there and read a book or whatever, so we started giving away free books there, teaching chess.
About how many kids do you serve?
It varies depending on the time of year. Right now it's cold outside, so a lot of kids try and stay in after school. But last summer we served over 2,000 lunches. To give you an idea of how many kids come there on a day-to-day basis, anywhere from, in the summertime, we might get anywhere between 20 to 70 kids, depending on what the weather's like. If it's kind of rainy, then not as many kids want to come out for the free lunch for the enrichment programs. But we've had over 100 kids on certain days with certain programs. On average, after school for tutoring, we might see up to 20 kids. On the weekends, Sunday, we have MSU students come out that volunteer and work enrichment programs with kids. We might get anywhere from 10 to 15 kids. It varies from day to day, and it actually varies with the weather.
We got a lot of volunteers, but we don't have enough. And one of the things I like to say is that we are always trying to get people involved to help do tutoring. We're always trying to get people involved to come and volunteer at the Village Summit.
Is there a story that encapsulates why you started this program and why you do what you do?
The story that kind of impresses me the most, or that really made me see the impact of this, is that when I started this, I used to be in the Marine Corps, and I had saw a problem. I'm going to attack this problem. I'm going to knock it out. And I'm going to fix this problem of kids, the violence in the neighborhood, the hunger, and all this other stuff. But as I started working, somebody said, hey, he's doing this for our kids. One of the neighbors came by and started helping me paint. Doesn't have kids in the neighborhood, but she says, I like that you're doing this for the neighbors. And she said, I'm going to come here and paint and help clean and do this, that, and the other thing. Then another neighbor, Rocky Prudencio Morris, said, I'm going to help knock out the landscaping and help you build this handicap ramp. And all of a sudden, I saw a change, not just in the neighborhood, but in myself. The me that used to want to attack the problem and solve it all myself had to suddenly share the problem of fixing this house. And the neighbors started taking ownership of the house and started taking ownership of the problem. All of a sudden, it became a thing where one neighbor, two neighbor, three neighbor, all these neighbors started coming together and say, well, I can help fix this window, and I can help fix this, and I can help donate this and do this and work with kids. So it became more of a community thing. It wasn't a person fixing a problem. It was it became a process where people are continually fixing a problem, and it became a group and collective effort. I learned a lot and changed a lot with it, and I think the community learned and changed a lot with it, being able to be involved and be a part of something or being able to contribute. And they didn't have money to contribute, but they had time, effort, and skills to contribute. And I think that's the most amazing thing that has occurred, the change in people that's occurred.
The Village Summit turned into a resource center. People would come to the Village Summit to borrow tools. And the thing is, they would borrow tools, but they didn't sign them out. You needed something, you come get it, and you take it and use it. Mm-hmm. When you finish, you bring it back. And when we saw people in the community actually returning tools, and then not only that, taking pride in the Village Summit as a part of the neighborhood.
You knew you'd hit on something.
We knew. We knew that Marcus had a great idea.
Where is it? We haven't established that.
It's on 119 East Barnes, Lansing, Michigan, 48910. It's just north of Mount Hope, in the corner of Mount Hope in Washington, just south of Baker in Washington. It's squared right in the middle of Lansing, inside of an interesting area, an older neighborhood, about 100 years old.
We're talking with Marcus Brown and Amel Island, who are respectively the co-founder and the president of the Village Summit here in Lansing. You've talked about your volunteers and how much you rely on them. Where does your funding come from?
We do have some people that make donations of coats and books and so forth, and we do get money from time to time to help us cover certain things, but I would say probably 80-90% of the money comes from my wife and I paying this bill and that bill. When I say that, it sounds like a lot, but when you really look at the cost of running the center, it's very minimal. There are no salaries given out.
Right.
So we're paying straight utilities, we're paying for the internet costs, and we're paying for repairs here and there.
This is a grassroots effort.
Grassroots effort. And then when people come along, a lot of if I need some plumbing done, I got a neighbor who will come. I'll come fix this for you. So our costs are minimalized by that. Our greatest cost is our tax bill yearly, since it's not a couple cannot homestead two properties. We have to pay at a higher tax rate on the Village Summit because it's not a homestead.
And so, utilities.
Yeah, and utilities. So.
And if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do it?
At villagesummit@hotmail.com. Or they can take a look at us on Facebook, Village Summit Lansing, or they can get in contact with us at villagesummit.org and see some of the stuff that we're up to. Our address is 119 East Barnes, Lansing, Michigan. And our phone number is 517-575-5749.
Marcus Brown is a co-founder of the Village Summit. Amel Island is the president. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you
for having us, sir.
Thank you.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there doing excellent work. We need to know about them, though. Please help us out. Send us an email about these great nonprofits in the area to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. More than a billion people around the world live without access to electricity. This lack of energy is a huge barrier to economic growth in developing countries. And as our next guest, John Barry, knows, providing energy for something as simple as a light can make a huge difference. John Berry is the executive director of the Appropriate Technology Collaborative. The Ann Arbor-based organization creates new and sustainable technology for communities in developing countries. John Berry, welcome to Current State.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
You altered your career path as a result of something that happened on a trip 10 years ago to Ecuador. What happened on that trip?
Well, I'm a designer. I am an architect and also an industrial designer. I design products. And I was traveling through rural parts of Ecuador, and I noticed that up at 11,000 feet, people are boiling during the day, just tremendously hot. Houses are unbearable. And then at night, it freezes. Mm. People have frost developing on the ceiling of their house. It's like living in an icebox. And I realized that as a designer, I could make a passive solar house with the same materials and the same costs that would be naturally cool in the day and warm at night.
And you did that. Tell us about the design for that and the impact that it's had.
Well, we've had several houses now go up that are models, is demonstration homes, really, that show people how to do it themselves. And that's really where the action is trying to help people develop the skills to better their own lives.
And you mentioned passive solar housing. Give us just a quick thumbnail a description of what you mean by a passive solar house.
Well, it doesn't have solar panels on it like electrical panels. What it does is it lets the sun come in during the daytime in a controlled fashion. It heats up dense surfaces made out of concrete, and then it gives off that heat in the evening. It slowly warms up during the day, and in the evening, it reaches its peak temperature sometime around 9 at night.
And what other kinds of products are you creating?
Well, with a group of Michigan State engineering students, we designed a solar vaccine refrigerator that can be built anywhere in the world. The problem is that billions of dollars of vaccines spoil trying to get the last mile to the clients. In rural parts of the world, there simply is no electricity. There's no refrigeration. We designed a fridge you could build anywhere with the Michigan State team. And they went down to Guatemala and proved it could be built in just 4 days. And they froze things on the fifth day.
Amazing. And you brought a product of your design, I take it, with you here today.
We specified how this works. The actual look of the product was somebody else's.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But we have a small solar light with a solar panel. And the solar panel looks just like a real solar panel or a big solar panel, but it's miniature. It's about 6 inches on a side. And you put the solar panel on a roof, and you take the light and you put it in a house, and you can replace burning kerosene or candles to see at night. People who burn kerosene and candles to see at night inhale a lot of fumes, yeah. And they spend a lot of money. They spend $2 to $4 a week on kerosene and candles. This costs about $30. So after 15 weeks, it's paid for itself. Then people are really saving money. They're saving a few dollars a week. For some of our clients, that's 25%, an increase of 25% in their disposable income.
And there's a health benefit as well.
Tremendous health benefit.
In terms of the respiration. How do you go about determining what kind of technologies? I mean, is the solar piece a big part of the products you're designing?
Yes. There's several reasons for that. One is you mentioned a billion people don't have electricity, and so they're all trying to see at night, so they're all burning candles and kerosene. They can save money by switching over to solar and using LED lights. We're also now training women to install solar. That's basic carpentry skills and then electronic skills. We have an electronics class for these women. They learn about circuits, controls, and then how to make a circuit using a solar panel and lights and usually a cell phone charger. And they're installing panels on people's roofs and lights inside their houses. And it's people really like a system where they have a switch on the wall. I don't know why that's so important to people, but having a switch on the wall by the front door is one of the really cool things you can have in life, apparently. it's wonderful. I mean, we get to really make a lot of people happy.
That's fantastic. We should also point out another feature of the product that you brought with you today, which, again, is just a small 6-inch by 6-inch solar panel connected to just a very modest kind of light fixture.
Mm-hmm.
If you disconnect the light fixture from the solar panel, you've created what?
This has a small USB port on it, and you can charge your cell phone with it. So this collects enough energy during the day to both shine for about 4 hours at night and charge a cell phone. And I'll tell you something. I was amazed to find out that pretty much everybody in the world has a cell phone
now. It's amazing, isn't it?
In Guatemala, where we work, you can purchase a cell phone, a used one, for about $2. And you can receive phone calls for free. So everybody has a phone, and it's on all the time. That actually is a burden to people, because people who don't have electricity have to hike sometimes 90 minutes to get to a place where they can charge their cell phones. And they're doing this a couple times a week.
Amazing.
And they just wait there while the cell phone charges, and then they hike back. They lose a day's work.
It is. I was in Jordan not quite 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and all around us there were Bedouins on camels. The landscape probably hadn't – it looked very much like it did probably 100, 150 years ago, with one exception. All of them had cell phones to their ears on their camels.
Mm-hmm.
It was really an amazing sight.
Well, that is the way the world is now.
It
I think there's
is.
More cell phones on, yes. on planet Earth than there are people.
Yeah. How do you sustain the technology that you build? Is that an issue?
Well, this light is for sale. We don't give things away. We're a nonprofit, but we're not a charity. We don't give stuff away.
Okay.
We believe that the market is the best way of distributing technologies. There isn't enough charity in the world to give everybody a light, but most of our clients can afford one because they're already spending the money on candles and kerosene.
I see.
And so we can distribute thousands of these a year through businesses. We're starting 3 businesses this year in Guatemala alone, and then we're expanding it beyond the borders of Guatemala in 2015.
Is the Mayan Power and Light Project one of those?
Well, yes, the Mayan Power and Light Project is the education of Mayan women in circuits, electricity, and solar power, and then how to design and install solar power systems. And they're starting businesses. The Mayan women are starting businesses. We're helping them with business incubation services.
I take it 10 years ago, this was quite a – how big a career transformation was this for you 10 years ago to launch this?
Well, 10 years ago, I had relatively few very affluent clients. And that's the way architecture works. And that's my primary design projects were architectural. And now I have billions of clients who don't have very many resources. We run a nonprofit. We ask for donations, and foundations support us.
We're talking with John Barry, our special guest here today on Current State. Have you considered doing any projects domestically? Are you involved in anything in the United States?
We have a project that we're rolling out, hopefully this year, in Detroit. Many people who live in Detroit can't afford their utility bills. And they get cut off from electricity sometime in the spring. And they're spending up to $2 a charge to charge their cell phones at the liquor store, at the check cashing store,
okay.
or the local market. And so we have the same light design for people who don't have electricity in Detroit. It has a more robust battery, and it can charge a bigger phone.
And you have some Michigan State University students you alluded to that are involved with you. Tell us more about them.
Well, we've had several projects with Michigan State University students. Our solar vaccine refrigerator, which is our G-Wiz technology, because it has no moving parts. It does not use electricity of any kind. You put it in the sun, and it freezes stuff. It boggles people's minds to hear that, but it works, and contact me if you want to know how it works. I'm not going to go into a description here. But that was designed by Michigan State University students. It's pure genius. Engineering students are incredibly capable people. And we've worked almost every year we've had a project with Michigan State.
Before we let it slip through the cracks, you have a website or someplace where people can learn more about the Appropriate Technology Collaborative?
Sure. You could Google Appropriate Technology, and we'd be in the first page of Google, or www.app, Tech Design, APPTECHDESIGN.org.
And what role do you see new technologies like the ones you develop playing in eradicating poverty?
Well, this light, we have returned to the first installations we did 6 years ago of lights like this, and we're finding that the families who have dirt floors living off the grid, their children are doing their homework at night. The women are doing weaving and needlepoint work at night, which they couldn't before. The lights weren't bright enough. So they have more things to sell on the market. The kids are doing better in school. And one family was telling me that they're sending their daughter to trade school, which is essentially out of poverty in one generation because they bought a light.
That is extraordinary. John Berry is the executive director for the Appropriate Technology Collaborative. He's based in Ann Arbor. Great visiting with you, John. Good luck.
Good talking with you.
Current state on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Two popular Cadillac models are built here in Lansing at the Grand River Assembly Plant. The Cadillac ATS won the North American Car of the Year Award last year, and the CTS was a finalist for the award this year. Later this year, a two-door coupe version of the ATS will begin rolling off the Lansing Grand River assembly line. You can see the new coupe through Sunday at the North American International Auto Show in Detroit. International sales are crucial to Cadillac's success. Current state Scott Pohl joins us to help us understand the important role of global sales for GM. Good morning, Scott.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Real good. Tell us more.
Well, I went to the Detroit Auto Show last week, and one of the people I talked with was Jim Verpalat. He's director of emerging markets for Cadillac, working on sales in places like Canada, Mexico, Europe, Russia, the Middle East, and China.
So I spent a lot of time making sure that we're growing the brand, we're putting emphasis on the brand, and that's been a kind of a departure for us. You know, we've exported cars for years at Cadillac, but now it's really it's a sustained growth strategy that in those markets we really want to grow the brand. And it's a fun job. It's enjoyable, and I get to work with a lot of great people and a lot of different cultures.
When we think of exporting Cadillacs, one country that comes to mind is China. We hear about the popularity of Cadillacs in China. Are you involved with sales in China?
Yeah, I am. And you know what's great in China is we put in a strategy in place about 10 years ago to really grow the brand, and we're starting to see the fruits of that payoff. Last year set an all-time sales record in China. They were up over 60% year over year, sold over 50,000 Cadillacs. Primarily, most of those shipped from the U.S. and imported into China. Now, our strategy will change a little bit as we've gathered a pretty strong base of sales. We'll start to shift to local manufacturer to kind of avoid it's about a 20% import duty. But still, the good news for us is most of those components are still built in the United States. We ship them to China and then do final assembly there.
Tell me how marketing Cadillac differs in other countries compared to what we're used to seeing in terms of marketing here in the United States.
Interestingly enough, it's probably more similar than different because it's a luxury brand. So we work to try to keep and make sure that the brand is consistent in how it's represented, but at the same time maybe adjust a little bit for cultural differences. And you know, one thing that I can point to is China still makes pretty extensive use of celebrity endorsement, a little less here in the U.S. The more developed a market is, they tend to rely less on big celebrity endorsement. But for the XTS sedan that we introduced there, the team in China really wanted to make a big statement. So they did a commercial with the XTS that used a very well-known celebrity here in the United States, Brad Pitt. And it's not something we would do around the world, but it works for that market. But kind of the positioning of the brand, the things that how we showcase it and how we represent it are really consistent around the world. And, you know, because today with the internet and, you know, we introduced something here in Detroit today, everybody in the Middle East is getting it. Everybody in Russia is getting it. Everybody worldwide sees what we're doing here. So it's really critical for a luxury brand to be consistent.
You say today, as we record this, Cadillac is taking the wraps off a new coupe version of the ATS. Is that the sort of car that you think will succeed in other countries? Clearly, Cadillac plans on it succeeding in the U.S. Mm-hmm. How does that fit into the international marketplace?
Well, the segment that the ATS is in is compact luxury. And that segment is the largest, not just here in the United States, but it's the largest globally. So it's a very important segment. And in some cases, some of the markets, that segment represents even more than it does here in the United States. So a very critical product. And, you know, to have multiple body styles in a very large segment helps you kind of broaden appeal, bring new buyers into the market and new buyers into the brand. And that's what we expect the coupe to do, whether that's here in the U.S. or on a global basis.
Having cars built in Lansing, Michigan, I assume it makes it easy to export to Canada, but are vehicles built in Lansing among those that are also exported around the world? You mentioned some of the assembly that is done in some other countries. Where do Lansing-built cars go?
Everywhere, and which is a good thing for us. You know, that's our home base, really. And, you know, whether it's Mexico, Russia, into the Middle East, all those cars are built right in Lansing Grand River and then exported out. The only place that we're going to assemble really outside the U.S. Will be in China. And that's just mainly because of, you know, local rules and that import duty. You know, when you face that high import duty, it really puts you sometimes at a competitive disadvantage, especially if your competitors are producing in that local market.
The American marketplace hears Cadillac, and they know, at least initially, what kind of quality they're expecting, that sort of thing. What does the word Cadillac, the name Cadillac, mean in other countries? Does it have the same cachet around the world?
You know, that's probably the trickier part of my job. And, you know, Cadillac is, it's kind of like Coca-Cola. Anywhere around the world, people know the name. And two things always come up, luxury, American, which is a good thing. But there are differences. So when we're going into markets that have never had the brand, so when we launch the brand into, let's say, China, for instance, you know, they don't have the 60s, 70s, 80s heritage of the Cadillac brand. You really start anew. So it does pose a little bit of a difference. Same thing in the Middle East, places like that. They haven't had the brand as long as we've had here, so there are nuances to how you market it. And, you know, interestingly, in China, we actually had to make sure that people understood that the brand was attainable, because the only time they ever saw a Cadillac was a very rare instance for extremely wealthy. So it was almost up on par with a Rolls-Royce type vehicle. And we had to say, no, this is right in line with BMW, Mercedes. So a few challenges here and there, but the good thing is, you know, Cadillac is luxury, and Cadillac's American, and those are two great things that we can build on regardless of where we market it.
Where does Cadillac fit in internationally in terms of pricing with its competitors? Again, I think an American audience has an idea of where a Cadillac would fit into their budget as opposed to the competition. Is it similar in other countries? Is Cadillac perhaps more affordable in some countries in comparison to its competition, less affordable? How does that work?
You know, what we try to do is, you know, the good thing is we compete against many of the same products regardless of what market you're in. So for us, it's, you know, it's the BMWs, the Mercedes, the Audis, the Lexuses of the world. So where we, how we position the brand here in the U.S. from a pricing standpoint is pretty similar to where we've positioned the brand on a global basis regardless of market we're in. Because again, we really don't want, we want that consistency. We want it to be in that same position around the world. So you wouldn't find many differences as you go around the world, sometimes because of local taxes, local duties. The cars are more, you know, could be more expensive, but then again, you know, the BMW is more expensive than you might find here. So on a relative basis, it's very similar.
Are there international markets that you would like greater penetration in, or markets you'd like to enter where Cadillac isn't currently available?
You know, we're focused on the markets we're in right now to try to grow those and develop those, but there's a couple markets around the world that we're kind of eyeing. You know, we're not officially on sale, believe it or not, in South America. There are some Cadillacs that get sent there, but, you know, I think that's going to be the next area you see us enter into South America. You know, we got our eyes a little bit on in the Indian market. You're seeing a lot of growth in the luxury market there and really stability in the region. So those are two areas we're probably going to look at, but nothing really that close on the horizon, again, because we're really trying to focus on growing the brand, you know, in the markets that we're in today.
Have there been roadblocks in those countries preventing Cadillac's entry?
I wouldn't call it roadblocks. It's more, you know, when we go into a market, we want to be very focused. We want to have the investment ready. We want, you know, entering a market isn't a small task because you have to set up a dealer network. You've got to, you know, kind of over advertise to let you know, let everybody know that you're there. So there's a lot of things that you have to set up. So for us, it's more when we go, we want to be able to have the investment sustainability. So no real major roadblocks. The things we look at are, you know, the size of the luxury market, the tax situation, duty situation. You look at all of those as you make a decision to enter a market. But I wouldn't call them roadblocks. It's more, when are we ready to go, and can we go, in a sense, in force and have a long-term strategy?
Jim Verpalat is Director of Emerging Markets for Cadillac. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it. And, you know, we couldn't be happier. 2014 is going to be a great year because we're coming off a phenomenal 2013.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And tomorrow, we get an update on General Motors' decision to move production of the Camaro from Ontario to the Lansing Grand River Assembly Plant here in town. That's our show for today. Also coming up tomorrow on Current State, we hear from communities outside of Lansing who are served by the Lansing Board of Water and Light and who want representation on the BWL board. State Representative Sam Singh of East Lansing and Delta Township Supervisor Ken Fletcher join us. Also, we speak with actor Jeff Daniels of Newsroom and Dumb and Dumber fame. All of that and more Thursday here on Current State. The executive producer of our show is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is Current State's producer. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl. Also, Aaron Young, thank you for engineering. Hannah Michaeljohn for production assistance as well. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR. ¶¶